Famloy ang glawa na kadulor ali fataga. Famloy ang glawa na kadulor ali fataga. Famloy ang glawa na kadulor ali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 65th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. We'll be opening today with part 30 of Teddy Roosevelt's book Through the Brazilian Wilderness, then we'll be having a musical number from 1925, and then for the main feature, we're continuing with part 5 of Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 30. By the morning of January 5th, we had left the marsh region. There were low hills here and there, and the land was covered with dense forest. From time to time we passed little clearings with palm-thatched houses. We were approaching Cathares, where the easiest part of our trip would end. We had lived in much comfort on the little steamer. The food was plentiful and the cooking good. At night we slept on deck, in cots or hammocks. The mosquitoes were rarely troublesome, although in the daytime we were sometimes bothered by the numbers of biting horseflies. The bird life was wonderful. One of the characteristic sights we were always seeing was that of a number of heads and necks of cormorants and snake birds without any bodies, projecting above the water and disappearing as the steamer approached. Skimmers and thick-billed tern were plentiful here, right in the heart of the continent. In addition to the spurred lapwing, characteristic and most interesting resident of most of South America, we found tiny red-legged plover, which also breed and are at home in the tropics. The contrasts in habits between closely allied species are wonderful. Among the plovers and bay snipe, there is a species that live all the year round in almost the same places, in tropical and subtropical lands, and other related forms which wander over the whole earth and spend nearly all their time, now in the Arctic and cold temperate regions of the far north, now in the cold temperate regions of the south. These latter, wide-wandering birds of the seashore and the riverbank, pass most of their lives in regions of almost perpetual sunlight. They spend the breeding season, the northern summer, in the land of midnight sun during the long Arctic day. They then fly for the endless distances across the north temperate zone, across the equator, through the lands where the days and nights are almost of equal length, and into another hemisphere, and spend another summer of long days and long twilights in the far south, where the Antarctic winds cool them, while their nesting home at the other end of the world is shrouded beneath the iron desolation of the polar night. In the late afternoon of the 5th, we reached the quaint, old-fashioned little town of São Luís de Cáceres, on the outermost fringe of the settled region of the state of Mato Grosso, the last town we should see before reaching the villages of the Amazon. As we approached, we passed half-clad black washerwomen on the river's edge. The men with the local band were gathered at the steeply sloping foot of the main street, where the steamer came up to her moorings. Groups of women and girls, white and brown, watched us from the low bluff. Their skirts and bodices were red, blue, and green, of all colours. Sig had gone ahead with much of the baggage. He met us in an improvised motorboat, consisting of a dugout, to the side of which he clamped our Evinrude motor. He was giving several of the local citizens of prominence a ride to their huge enjoyment. The streets of the little town were unpaved, with narrow brick sidewalks. The one-story houses were white or blue, with roofs of red tiles and window shutters of latticed woodwork, come down from colonial days and tracing back through Christian and Moorish Portugal to a remote Arab ancestry. Pretty faces, some dark, some light, looked out from the windows. Their mothers' mothers, for generations past, must have thus looked out of similar windows in the vanished colonial days. But now, even here in Cáceres, the spirit of the New Brazil is moving. A fine new government school has been started, and we met its principal, an earnest man doing excellent work, one of the many teachers who, during the last few years, have been brought to Mato Grosso from São Paulo, a centre of the new educational movement which will do so much good for Brazil. Father Zam went to spend the night with some French Franciscan friars, capital fellows. I spent the night at the comfortable house of Lieutenant Lyra, a hot-weather house with thick walls, big doors, and an open patio bordered by a gallery. Lieutenant Lyra was to accompany us. He was an old companion of Colonel Rondon's explorations. We visited one or two of the stores to make some final purchases, and in the evening strolled through the dusky streets under the trees of the plaza. The women and girls sat in groups in the doorways or at windows, and here and there a stringed instrument tinkled in the darkness. From Kerthery's onward, we were entering the scene of Colonel Rondon's explorations. For some 18 years he was occupied in exploring and in opening telegraph lines through the eastern or north middle part of the great forest state, the wilderness state of the Mato Grosso, the great wilderness, or, as Australians would call it, the bush. Then in 1907 he began to penetrate the unknown region lying to the north and west. He was the head of the exploring expeditions sent out by the Brazilian government to traverse the first time this unknown land, to map for the first time the upper courses of the rivers, which from the same divide run into the upper portions of the Tapajós and the Madeira, two of the mighty affluents of the Amazon, and to build telegraph lines across the Madeira, where a line of Brazilian settlements, connected by a steamboat, lines and a railroad, again occurs. 3 times he penetrated into this absolutely unknown Indian-haunted wilderness, being absent for a year or two at a time, and suffering every imaginable hardship, before he made his way across through to the Madeira and completed the telegraph line across. The officers and men of the Brazilian army and the civilian scientists who followed him shared the toil and the credit for the task. Some of his men died of beriberi, some were killed or wounded by the Indians. He himself almost died of a fever. Again and again his whole party was reduced almost to the last extremity by starvation, disease, hardship, and the overexhaustion due to the wearing fatigues. In dealing with the wild, naked savages, he showed a combination of fearlessness, wariness, good judgment, and resolute patience and kindliness. The result was that they ultimately became his firm friends, guarded the telegraph lines, and helped the few soldiers left at the isolated, widely separated little posts. He and his assistants explored and mapped for the first time the Jurena and the Gai Parana, two important affluents of the Tapajós and the Madeira respectively. The Tapajós and the Madeira, like the Orinoco and the Rio Negro, have been highways of travel for a couple of centuries. The Madeira, as later the Tapajós, was the chief means of ingress, a century and a half ago, to the little Portuguese settlements of this far interior region of Brazil, one of these little towns, named Mato Grosso, being the original capital of the province. It has long been abandoned by the government, and practically so by its inhabitants, the ruins of palace, fortress, and church now rising amid the rank tropical luxuriance of the wild forest. The mouths of these main affluents of these highway rivers were, as a rule, well known, but in many cases nothing but the mouth was known. The river itself was not known, and it was placed on the map by guesswork. Colonel Rondon found, for example, that the course of the Gai Parana was put down on the map 2 degrees out of its proper place. He, with his party, was the first to find its sources, the first to traverse its upper course, the first to map its length. He and his assistants performed a similar service on the Jurena, discovering the sources, discovering the descending of some of the branches, and for the first time making a trustworthy map of the main river itself, until its junction with the Tapajós. Near the watershed between Jurena and the Gai Parana, he established his farthest station to the westward, named Jos Bonifacio, after one of the chief Republican patriots of Brazil. A couple of days' march northwestward from this station, he in 1909 came across a part of the stream of a river running northward between Gai Parana and Jurena. He could only guess where it debouched, believing it to be into the Madeira, although it was possible that it entered the Gai Parana or the Tapajós. The region through which it flows was unknown, no civilized man having ever penetrated it, and as all conjecture as to what the river was as to its length and to its place of entering into some highway river were mere guesswork, he had entered it on his sketch maps as the Rio da Duvida, the River of Doubt. Among the officers of the Brazilian army and the scientific civilians who had accompanied him, there have been not only expert cartographers, photographers, and telegraphists, but astronomers, geologists, botanists, and zoologists. Their reports, published in excellent shape by the Brazilian government, make an invaluable series of volumes, reflecting the highest credit on the explorers and on the government itself. Colonel Rondon's own accounts of his explorations, of the Indian tribes he has visited, and of the beautiful and wonderful things he has seen, possess a peculiar interest. The music for today is a track by the Tennessee Happy Boys from 1925. It's called Sweet Georgia Brown. Thank you. And now on to our main feature. As I've told you already, it's part 5 of The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Chapter 3. A Search and an Evocation. Part 1. Charles Ward, as we have seen, first learned in 1918 of his descent from Joseph Kirwan. That he at once took an intense interest in everything pertaining to the bygone mystery is not to be wondered at, for every vague rumour that he had heard of Kirwan now became something vital to him, in whom flowed Kirwan's blood. No spirited or imaginative genealogist could have done otherwise than begin forthwith an avid and systematic collection of Kirwan data. In his first delvings, there was not the slightest attempt at secrecy, so that even Dr. Lyman hesitates to date the youth's madness from any period before the close of 1919. He talked freely with his family, though his mother was not particularly pleased to own an ancestor like Kirwan, and with the officials of the various museums and libraries he visited. In applying to private families for records thought to be in their possession, he made no concealment of his object, and shared the somewhat amused scepticism with which the accounts of the old diaries and letter writers were regarded. He often expressed a keen wonder as to what really had taken place a century and a half before at the Pawtuxet farmhouse, whose site he vainly tried to find, and what Joseph Kirwan really had been. When he came across the Smith diary and archives, and encountered the letter from Jebediah Orne, he decided to visit Salem and look up Kirwan's early activities and connections there, which he did during the Easter vacation of 1919. At the Essex Institute, which was well known to him from former sojourns in the glamorous old town of crumbling Puritan gables and clustered gambrel roofs, he was very kindly received, and unearthed there a considerable amount of Kirwan data. He found that his ancestor was born in Salem Village, now Danvers, 7 miles from town, on the 18th of February, O.S., 1662-1663, and that he had run away to sea at the age of 15, not appearing again for 9 years, when he returned to the speech, dress, and manners of a native Englishman and settled in Salem proper. At that time he had little to do with his family, and spent most of his hours with the curious books he had brought from Europe, and the strange chemicals which came for him on ships from England, France, and Holland. Certain trips of his into the country were the objects of much local inquisitiveness, and were whisperingly associated with vague rumours of fires on the hills at night. Kirwan's only close friends had been one Edward Hutchinson of Salem Village, and one Simon Orme of Salem. With these men he was often seen in conference about the common, and visits among them were by no means infrequent. Hutchinson had a house well out towards the woods, and it was not altogether liked by sensitive people, because of the sounds heard there at night. He was said to entertain strange visitors, and the light seen from his windows was not always of the same colour. The knowledge he displayed concerning long-dead persons and long-forgotten events was considered distinctly unwholesome, and he disappeared about the time the witchcraft panic began, never to be heard of again. At that time Joseph Kirwan also departed, but his settlement in Providence was soon learned of. Simon Orne lived in Salem until 1720, when his failure to grow visibly old began to excite attention. He thereafter disappeared, though 30 years later his precise counterpart and self-styled son turned up to claim his property. The claim was allowed on the strength of documents in Simon Orme's known hand, and Jebediah Orne continued to dwell in Salem until 1771, when certain letters from Providence citizens to the Reverend Thomas Bernard and others brought about his quiet removal to parts unknown. Certain documents by and about all of the strange characters were available at the Essex Institute, the courthouse, and the registry of deeds, and included both harmless commonplaces such as land titles and bills of sale, and furtive fragments of a more provocative nature. There were 4 or 5 unmistakable allusions to them on the witchcraft trial records, as when one Hebediah Lawson swore on July 10th, 1692, at the court of Oyer and Terminer, under Judge Hawthorne, that 40 witches and the black men were wont to meet in the woods behind Mr. Hutchinson's house. Also one Amity, who declared at a session of August 8th before Judge Gedney, that Mr. G.B., Reverend George Burroughs, on that night put ye devil his mark upon Bridget S., Jonathan A., Simon O., Deliverance W., Joseph C., Susan P., Mehetabel C., and Deborah B. Then there was a catalogue of Hutchinson's uncanny library as found after his disappearance, and an unfinished manuscript in his handwriting, couched in a cipher none could read. Ward had a photostatic copy of this manuscript made, and began to work casually on the cipher as soon as it was delivered to him. After the following August, his labours on the cipher became intense and feverish, and there is reason to believe, from his speech and conduct, that he hit upon the key before October or November. He never stated, though, whether or not he had succeeded. But of greatest immediate interest was the Yawn material. It took Ward only a short time to prove from that identity of penmanship a thing he had already considered established from the text of the letter to Kirwan, namely that Simon Orne and his supposed son were one and the same person. As Orne had said to his correspondent, it was hardly safe to live too long in Salem. Hence he resorted to a 30-year-old sojourn abroad, and did not return to claim his lands except as a representative of a new generation. Orne had apparently been careful to destroy most of his correspondence, but the citizens who took action in 1771 found preserved a few letters and papers which excited their wonder. There were cryptic formulae and diagrams in his and other hands, which Ward now either copied with care or had photographed, in a chirography that the searcher recognised from items in the Registry of Deeds, and positively, Joseph Kirwan's. This Kirwan letter, though undated as to the year, was evidently not the one in answer to which Orne had written the confiscated missive, and from internal evidence Ward placed it not much later than 1750. It may not be amiss to give the text in full as a sample of the style of one whose history was so dark and terrible. The recipient is addressed as Simon, but a line, whether drawn by Kirwan or Orne, Ward could not tell, is run through the word. Providence, 1st May. Brother, my honoured ancient friend, due respects and earnest wishes to him who we serve for ye eternal power. I am just come upon that which you ought to know concerning the matter of the last extremity, and what to do regarding Y.T. I am not disposed to follow you in going away on account of my years, for Providence hath not ye sharpness of ye bay in hunting out uncommon things and bringing to trial. I am tied up in ships and goods, and could not do as you did. Besides with the which, my farm at Portaxet hath under it what ye know, and would not wait for my coming back as another. But I am unready for hard fortunes, as I have told you, and have long worked upon ye way of getting back after ye last. I last night struck on ye words that bring up Yogi Sothoth, and saw for ye first time that face spoke of by Ibn Shakabeo in ye blank. And it said that ye third psalm in ye Liber Damanatus holds ye clerical with sun in the fifth house, Saturn in trine, drawn ye pentagram of fire, and say ye ninth verse thrice. This verse repeat each Rudmus and Hallows Eve, and ye thing will breed in ye outer spheres. And of ye seed of old shall one be born who shall look back, though knowing not what he seeks. Yet this will avail nothing if there be no heir, and if the salts or the way to make the salts be not ready for his hand. And here I will own I have not taken needed steps, nor found much. Ye process is plagued hard to come near, and it used up such of store of specimens, I am hard put to it to get enough, notwithstanding the sailors I have from ye Indies. Ye people about are become curious, but I can stand them off. Ye gentry are worse than that populace, being more circumstantial in their acts, and more believing in what they tell. That parson, Mr. Merritt, have talked some, and I am fearful, but no thing so far is dangerous. Ye chemical substances are easier of getting, and there be two good chemists in town, Dr. Bowen and Sam Carew. I am following out what Borrelius saith, and have helped in Abdul al-Hazred's, his seventh book. Whatever I get, you shall have. And ye meanwhile, do not neglect to make use of ye words I have given here. I have them right, but if you desire to see him, employ the writings on ye piece of blank that I am putting in this packet. Say ye verses every Rudmus and Hallows Eve, and if ye line run out not, one shall be in years to come that shall look back and use what salts or stuff for salts you shall leave him. Job 9:14. I rejoice you are again at Salem, and hope I may see you not long hence. I have a good stallion, and am thinking of getting a coach, there being one Mr. Merritt's in Providence already, though the roads are bad. If you are disposed to travel, do not pass me by. From Boston take ye Post Road through Dedham, Wrentham, and Attenborough, good taverns being at all these towns. Stop at Mr. Balcombe's in Wrentham, where ye beds are finer than Mr. Hatch's, but eat at ye other house, for the cook is better. Turn into Providence by Pawtuxet Falls, and ye rode past Mr. Sale's tavern. My house, opposite Epitennis's Olney's tavern, off ye Town Street, first on ye north side of Olney Court, distance from Boston Stone about 44 miles. Sir, I am ye old and true friend and servant, in Almonds, in Metrotom. Joseph C. to Mr. Simon Orne, Williams Lane, in Salem. This letter, oddly enough, was what first gave Ward the exact location of Kirwan's Providence home, for none of the records encountered up to that time had been at all specific. The discovery was doubly striking because it indicated the newer Kirwan house, built in 1761, on the site of the old, a dilapidated building still standing in Olney Court and well known to Ward in his antiquarian rambles over Stamper's Hill. The place was indeed only a few squares from his own home on Great Hill's higher ground, and was now the abode of a negro family much esteemed for occasional washing, house-cleaning, and furnace-tending services. To find, in distant Salem, such sudden proof of the significance of this family rookery in his own family history was a highly impressive thing to Ward, and he resolved to explore the place immediately upon his return. The more mystical phrases of the letter, which he took to be some extravagant kind of symbolism, frankly baffled him, though he noted with a thrill of curiosity that the biblical passage referred to Job 14:14, and was the familiar verse, "If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait, until my change come." Part 2. Young Ward came home in a state of pleasant excitement, and spent the following Saturday in a long, exhaustive study of the house in Olney Court. The place, now crumbling with age, had never been a mansion, but was a modest 2.5-story wooden house of the familiar Providence colonial style, with plain peaked roof, large central chimney, and artistic carved doorway with rayed fanlight, a triangular pediment, and trim Doric pilasters. It had suffered but little alteration externally, and Ward felt he was gazing on something very close to the sinister matters of his quest. The negro inhabitants were known to him, and he was very courteously shown about the interior by old Azza and his stout wife Hannah. Here there was more change than the outside indicated, and Ward saw with regret that fully half of the fine scroll and urn overmantels and shell-carved cupboard linings were gone, whilst most of the fine wainscoting and Belectin moulding was marked, hacked and gouged, or covered up altogether with cheap wallpaper. In general, the survey did not yield as much as Ward had somehow expected, but it was at least exciting to stand within the ancestral walls which had housed such a man of horror as Joseph Kirwan. He saw with a thrill that a monogram had been very carefully effaced from the ancient brass knocker. From then on, until the close of school, Ward spent his time on the photostatic copy of the Hutchinson cipher and the accumulation of local Kirwan data. The former still proved unyielding, but of the latter he obtained so much and so many clues to similar data elsewhere that he was ready by July to make a trip to New London and New York to consult old letters whose presence in those places was indicated. The trip was very fruitful, for it brought him the Fenner letters with their terrible description of the Pawtuxet farmhouse raid, and the Nightingale Talbot letters in which he learned of the portrait painted on a panel of the Kirwan library. The matter of the portrait interested him particularly, since he would have given much to know what Joseph Kirwan looked like, and he decided to make a second search of the house in Olney Court to see if there might not be some trace of the ancient features beneath peeling coats of later paint or layers of mouldy wallpaper. Early in August that search took place, and Ward went carefully over the walls of every room sizable enough to have been by any possibility the library of the evil builder. He paid especial attention to the large panels of the overmantels, as still remained, and was keenly excited after about an hour, when on a broad area above the fireplace in a spacious ground-floor room he became certain that the surface brought out by the peeling of several coats of paint was sensibly darker than any ordinary interior paint, or the wood beneath it was likely to have been. A few more careful tests with a thin knife, and he knew he had come upon an oil portrait of great extent. With truly scholarly restraint, the youth did not risk the damage which an immediate attempt to uncover the hidden picture with the knife might have been, and just retired from the scene of his discovery to enlist expert help. In 3 days he returned with an artist of long experience, Mr. Walter C. Dwight, whose studio is near the foot of College Hill, and that accomplished restorer of paintings set to work at once with proper methods and chemical substances. Old Azar and his wife were duly excited over their strange visitors, and were properly reimbursed for this invasion of their domestic hearth. As day by day the work of restoration progressed, Charles Ward looked on with growing interest at the lines and shades gradually unveiled after their long oblivion. Dwight had begun at the bottom, hence, since the picture was a three-quarter length one, the face did not come out for some time. It was meanwhile seen that the subject was a spare, well-shaped man with dark blue coat, embroidered waistcoat, black satin small clothes, and white silk stockings, seated in a carved chair against a background of a window with wharves and ships beyond. When the head came out, it was observed to bear a neat Albemarle wig, and to possess a thin, calm, undistinguished face, which seemed somehow familiar to both Ward and the artist. Only at the very last, though, did the restorer and his client begin to grasp with astonishment at the details of that lean, pallid visage, and to recognise with a touch of awe the dramatic trick which heredity had played. For it took the final bath of the oil and the final stroke of the delicate scraper to bring out fully the expression which centuries had hidden, and to confront the bewildered Charles Dexter Ward, dweller in the past, with his own living features in the countenance of his horrible great-great-great-grandfather. Ward brought his parents to see the marvel he had uncovered, and his father at once determined to purchase the picture, despite its execution on a stationary panelling. The resemblance to the boy, despite the appearance of a rather great age, was marvellous, and it could be seen that through some trick of avatism the physical contours of Joseph Curwen had found the precise duplication after a century and a half. Mrs. Ward's resemblance to her ancestor was not at all marked, though she could recall relatives who had some of the facial characteristics shared by her son and the bygone Curwen. She did not relish the discovery, and told her husband that he had better burn the picture instead of bringing it home. There was, she averred, something unwholesome about it, not only intrinsically, but in its very resemblance to Charles. Mr. Ward, however, was a practical man of power and affairs, a cotton manufacturer with extensive mills at Riverport in the Pawtuxet Valley, and not one to listen to feminine scruples. The picture impressed him mightily with its likeness to his son, and he believed the boy deserved it as a present. In his opinion, it is needless to say, Charles most heartily concurred, and a few days later Mr. Ward located the owner of the house, a small rodent-featured person with a guttural accent, and obtained the whole mantle and overmantle bearing the picture at a curtly fixed price which cut short the impending torrent of unctuous haggling. It now remained to take off the panelling and remove it to the Ward home, where provisions were made for its thorough restoration and installation with an electric mock fireplace in Charles's third-floor study or library. To Charles was left the task of superintending this removal, and on the 28th of August he accompanied two expert workmen from the Crooker decorating firm to the house in Olney Court, where the mantel and portrait-bearing overmantel were detached with great care and precision for transport in the company's motor truck. There was left a space of exposed brickwork marking the chimney's course, and in this young Ward observed a cubical recess about a foot square, which must have lain directly behind the head of the portrait. Curious as to what such a space might mean or contain, the youth approached and looked within, finding beneath the deep coatings of dust and soot some loose yellowed papers, a crude, thick copybook, and a few mouldering textile shreds which may have formed the ribbon binding the rest together. Blowing away the bulk of the dirt and cinders, he took up the book and looked at the bold inscription on its cover. It was in a hand which he had learned to recognise at the Essex Institute, and proclaimed the volume as The Journal and Notes of Jos Curwen, Gent of Providence Plantations, late of Salem. Excited beyond measure by his discovery, Ward showed the book to the two curious workmen beside him. Their testimony is absolute as to the nature and genuineness of the finding, and Dr. Willett relies on them to help establish his theory that the youth was not mad when he began his major eccentricities. All the other papers were likewise in Kirwan's handwriting, and one of them seemed especially portentous because of its inscription: "To him who shall come after, and how he may get beyond time and ye spheres." Another was in a cipher, the same, Ward hoped, as the Hutchinson cipher, which had hitherto baffled him. A third, and here the searcher rejoiced, seemed to be a key to the cipher, whilst the fourth and fifth were addressed respectively to Edward Hutchinson Arminger and Jebediah Orne Esquire, or their heir or heirs, or those representing them. The sixth and last was inscribed Joseph Kirwan, his life and travels between the years of 1678 and 1687, of whither he voyaged, where he stayed, whom he saw, and what he learnt. And that's all for today. Opening music provided by Victor Valdez from the Symbol Project. This file is released under an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. So until next time... CthulhuPodcast.co.uk